Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Couple Speak Relationship Forum. I'm your host, Susan Lager, a psychotherapist and relationship coach at the Couple Center and Couple Speak in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, where I broadcast live each month on Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Tonight's 40-minute show on February 26, 2014 is called Marriage and Money, a Love Story. It's all about some patterns that couples get into around managing money and where those patterns serve couples well or undermine the partnership, creating mistrust, disrespect, and a general imbalance of power. Very exciting news. I will be co-hosting tonight and happily once a month from now on with my friend and esteemed colleague, Meredith Richardson, a very highly sought New England conflict management specialist who works as a mediator, facilitator, trainer, conflict coach, and collaborative lawyer in Maine and New Hampshire. Meredith is also a popular motivational speaker, midlife coach, and the creator of fabulous retreats. Meredith and I will be discussing perspectives from our different fields about this issue and sharing some tips for how couples can collaborate more effectively financially. Before we begin, though, one technical issue. Any caller wanting to join us live on the air with questions or comments can do so by dialing 1 on your phone, and you'll be in line to join us. We'll pause at intervals to take questions, so don't be shy about it. Hi, Meredith.
Hey, Susan. How are you?
I'm good. Freezing to death today, but happily tucked in now here. Very happy to be here and warm. How about you?
Yes, I was glad to avoid the snow flurries today and just have it be sunny out there. It was lovely.
I know. This is all we talk about in New England, according to my brother-in-law. He says, move to Florida and you'll have a different subject other than the weather. You know. The other thing
let's talk money about,
I don't know about you with people you know, but I hear about this a lot with colleagues and friends. About this time of year, everybody is agonizing about getting ready for tax time. Does that happen in your world?
Well, my uncle is an accountant, so he is the one that's having sleepless nights doing people's taxes.
Oh, poor guy.
Yeah, it is a rough time for him as well. But I think,
sure,
too, especially with the self-employed, it is a very tough time in terms of taxes.
Well, what happens, and you know this, is that we finish off the end of the business year or the corporate year in the end of September, so that we have to prepare those figures, and then we have to do the personal stuff before usually March, so we don't ambush our accountants. So it's a sort of two-for-one whammy that we're hit with. And I just find the whole thing, to me, I'd rather be kind of immersed in boiling water or a vat of oil than have to go every year. I hate it. What it does remind me about, though, are the patterns and that individuals and couples go through, that people exhibit, and what they demonstrate individually and together as far as how they manage money. And I'm sure you see that in your work also as a mediator and a conflict coach.
Absolutely. And I will say, when we talked about this before, one of the things we talked about is playing to people's strengths. And so some people, Susan, are actually very fortunate, and they have someone in their relationship who loves dealing with these numbers and really thinks it's fun to do taxes. So
really?
I would just want to give a shout-out to them. And that's not me. And clearly it's not you either.
No.
But if you do have someone, in your relationship that is doing this, then I think they deserve an extra gift around this time of year.
I think so. Kudos to them. Boy, they're performing a service that most of us hate. And even though a lot of it is just tabulation and it's mechanical, it's, I think part of what comes up for people is the whole issue of where has my money gone? It involves a lot of values pieces about what have we done with our money, where have we saved, what was worth spending what on. It brings up so many emotionally laden issues. It's not just the tabulating of figures to get them ready for the accountant or for the IRS.
No, not at all. And I think even when you have people, say you have two employees, or maybe you have someone who's an employer and an employee together, when you're talking about the values, you can have someone who intentionally tries to use this as a way to save money. And so they don't claim their dependency deductions because they want to have the maximum amount taken out so that then they can get a windfall around this time.
Uh-huh.
And then for other people, particularly the self-employed, you really look at ways to not have to pay the government anything extra on a quarterly basis. And so if you can just get to this point in time and not owe the government anything, it's a good thing. But you don't necessarily use it as a savings mechanism the way I think that a good amount of employees do. So if you have two people with those different values, then tax time can be quite problematic when the first tax refund comes back and it doesn't look anything like what that person who used to use it for savings is used to seeing.
Well, that's a very good point because it sounds like, you know, it creates built-in conflict if you have different styles or a different kind of attitude or value attached to how you use it. I see it in my work as one, money and money management in general, as one of the big three stressors in marriage: sex, money, and the kids. Although there's four, I've added a four recently. The fourth, I would say, is the division of labor around household chores and the management of the household. But money is really a big, big, potentially divisive issue for couples in committed relationships. And I think you're bringing up one of the points why, because it gets into differences that people have, different attitudes about how it's used and all of that.
Right. And even if you think that you have, you know, some basic fundamental similarities, if you think that you're both people who tend to save, having that difference of, well, I save by giving extra money to the government every week or 2 weeks in my paycheck versus, well, I save by putting it in my savings account and not giving the government an extra penny, that's very different ways of saving.
Yeah, yeah. And then how people reconcile those differences becomes grist for the mill. It's critical,
right,
how they come together around, you know, creating a kind of center around that, some kind of compromise or something that feels like it's mutually acceptable. Now, I'm wondering so obviously that's one thing that we will both see, you know, we both see in our work. I think it probably would be useful for us to, and I know we talked about this when we were thinking about the show and preparing for the show, if we could talk about some of the patterns that we each see in our respective roles, patterns around money management, and maybe to begin first with some of the problematic patterns that we see, and then maybe we could get into some tips we have for individuals and couples to do better moving forward. Does that sound like that would be a good format for you?
That sounds great.
Okay. One of the ones I see very often in my work with couples is a kind of collusion around avoidance or denial. And it's really so obvious when it's in the room. Couples who are just spending, and whenever they don't have the money for something, they just put it on a credit card and they'll worry about it tomorrow, or they're just not even thinking about having to be accountable to the IRS in any way. So they'll kind of get to that when they get to that. And the level of, you know, it's an avoidance of anxiety, it's an avoidance of responsibility, but it really creates big problems in a relationship. And I'm wondering if you see that a fair amount in on your end as a mediator.
I definitely see that as well. And I would agree with you when you had talked earlier about the reasons that couples break up. My husband's theme to me over the years has been that they break up over sex or money. So he's sort of on the same page as you are with that. But they don't tend to talk to me too much about the sex part. There's not anything I can do about that as the mediator.
Right.
And so they tend to talk to me about the money part because we have to figure out how to divide fair assets and liabilities. If they have children, we have to talk about child support. It could be that we're talking about spousal support. But we are taking a hard look at what they have and what they owe. And there are couples who just know, it seems that no matter how much money they make, they spend just a little bit more. It's a tough time because when they're coming to see me, then they're at a point where they don't want to live together anymore. And we have to sometimes have a difficult conversation about the fact that they really cannot afford to live apart. There's just
yep.
no way that it's possible given how they have spent to get to this point.
So they're really facing the music when they come to you. Do you feel that they're more likely to become more conscious of this pattern as having been problematic, or they just know that they're at odds, and that now they're behind the eight ball?
By the time they get to me, the pattern has really gotten them into trouble, and it's something where it can be an ugly realization for someone who has been sort of spending in denial for a long time to realize that there's no more money. It's just not possible that separating is not going to make this situation financially any better. It's actually going
yeah.
to make it worse and harder. I would say that for stereotypically women who are less involved with the money, it could be that the man takes on a more stereotypical role of being in charge of the money. And so you could see something where the other person is just spending and really not wanting to think about what the impact is in terms of a budget. Maybe they've tried to discuss a budget. Maybe there's been an allowance, but there ends up being sort of a parent-child dynamic going on. Or I also like to talk about it as shaking the money tree. And so if you just come and shake, you know, do a little shakedown, shake, 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 then there will be some money that comes. And ultimately, there's no more money left. There's no money. You can shake all you want, but there's no money.
Okay. All right. So that's, you know, obviously one that really gets couples into trouble. You know, I see that with some frequency, the parent-child dynamic. And it often is along gender lines, where often it's the man who's the higher earner who is in the parent role and controlling the money stream. Often women, in my experience, who are, they're at-home moms, so they're out of the workplace, and they're kind of oblivious about the money. Even if they're paying the bills, it's very interesting, even if they're the ones kind of following the bill paying, often, you know, the primary earner regulates what money is spent on what. And there are I see a lot of control issues playing out around that. And I see a lot of criticism, blaming, entitlement. I cannot tell you, Meredith, how many times I've sat with couples where the man, these are different couples, where the man will be highlighting the woman's spending and what is her spending. She's kind of nickel and diming it at Marshalls and TJ Maxx, so maybe she's spending a few hundred bucks a month, while he comes home with tractors or new cars or a boat or a snowmobile, so to the tune of at least $10,000. And then there's fights over, somehow there's different strokes for different folks, and it's really a toxic pattern, that parent-child dynamic. It's really poison for a relationship. And you see it when it's already too late.
I do see it when it's already too late. And I would say, too, that the child relationship can look a lot like that, too, though, in terms of, well, I need money for this, and I need money for this, and I need money for this, and the other person is going without and is really struggling to juggle everything that this person keeps adding onto the list. And so it's sort of an idea of, well, you can work harder, you can work longer, you can make it work. I don't know how you're going to make it work. I don't care how you're going to make it work. You just have to make it work because I need this.
Yeah. And it's the interesting thing is that I think with all of this, how couples manage money is so often emblematic of the other patterns in their life, how they manage other things. Like, you know, the person in the child role just kind of presuming that the primary provider will just pull a rabbit out of a hat. It's a very entitled, childlike position, and often you see that around other things. It's not just around money.
Right. It ends up being about, you know, how that person views their own needs versus the other person's needs.
Yeah, so, yeah. It's very divisive. It really divides couples terribly. Now, there's another dynamic that I see that I've worked with a couple recently where they really characterize this pattern, where there's hypervigilance and chronic anxiety. And this is more often the case among older couples. They're reaching retirement, and one person is, if not both, are they're chronically anxious about the lack of money. Our money, we're going to outlive our money. What are we going to do? A lot of hand-wringing, a lot of self-blame, a lot of regret. This is not what I expected. And part of what's so hard to watch and listen to it is that there's generally no action plan around it. It's just a kind of routinized hand-wringing with, it just doesn't go anywhere. And I'm wondering if something that manifests itself in your office also on the other end.
When I had a sad one actually recently where there was a difference in age between the two participants, and when we were trying to divide up the assets fairly, they were both fortunate in that they did have assets to divide, but the concern was, well, how long am I going to live? I don't have a way to make more assets. This is all well and good so long as I live what the life expectancy is for my gender. But what if I live 20 years beyond that? I'll have nothing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And
and
a
the
lot
other
of worry
person
and
did not want to be on the hook for this person for another 20 years.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it's so loaded. It's just such a loaded issue. And I think we're probably both seeing more couples where they're reaching supposed retirement age, and so many of them lost, I don't know, maybe 40% of what they had in investments in the stock market in the crash in the last few years. So now it really ramps up the anxiety level and the sense of helplessness and often shame. I should have known better. Why did I do this? A lot of self-recrimination, just a lot of very, really sad stuff that you see unfolding.
Right.
The other thing...
For me, I think the shame happens more with the men than the women that I see. They're more likely to feel shameful about not having, well, because there's such a, you know, society still expects men to be more of the providers. And
mm-hmm.
So if there's not enough that's been provided for, then it's seen more as a failing on their part.
I'm not a good husband. I'm not a good provider. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. It's a lot of pressure, particularly on
it
men.
Is.
in this culture. And I think it's moving more into a kind of even playing field where more women are feeling it as women are more often the primary provider also. But I do think the culture really lays that on men about that's part of your success as a husband. You're supposed to take care of your wife, and if you did something wrong, you didn't anticipate something, well, you're screwed. You're just not a good husband.
Right, and it plays out later, too. I would say that, you know, there's a lot of publicity given to, quote, deadbeat dads, end quote, and so you'll see these wanted posters with dads that don't pay child support, and dads that don't pay child support really are penalized for it in the court system. But I've seen many cases where dads said, no, I don't need child support from her. It's okay. And the court has gone along with that. And so there's a gender bias that's, you know, happening first by the participants, the dad saying, you know, I'm the provider, so I can still do this. I don't need to take any money from this person. And then the court system as well, because the court will sign off on that more often than signing off on a woman saying, no, I don't need child support from this man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure that plays out, and you see that in your world. Not good. Not a good scene. Now, the other thing, Meredith, you mentioned, I see a lot, and I think is worth kind of highlighting, is I call it the wrong shoe on the wrong foot, where there are another pattern is stereotype roles not based on strengths rather than a strength-based role, just stereotype kind of automatic default roles where there's an assumption that if you've always done the money, you've always run the money, then you're the one who runs the money, rather than really looking at who's better with numbers, do either of us have ADD so that maybe we're handicapped in this department, who likes
it? Or dyslexic.
Yeah, dyslexic, exactly. Exactly. So that's another one that really gets a lot of couples into trouble. And one of the things I do, I recently did this with a couple, was this guy had major mood disorder, had serious ADD, serious depression, and somehow they had allocated the role of the money management to him, and I encouraged them to switch roles, that maybe he could be the one cleaning the house and taking care of the physical things around the house, and his wife, who didn't have ADD and didn't have a mood disorder, was more stable emotionally, might be better suited to running the figures. And it was like, I don't know, like I had suggested something. I was a sage from on high. It had never even occurred to them. So that would be something I would encourage couples to do, to really make conscious, deliberate decisions about who's managing the money.
Right, to really play to the strengths. That's what you and I had talked about, was, you know, don't just look at it from the stereotypical gender perspective of, you know, stereotypically men doing this type of work. Look at it from who actually gets it done, who knows how to balance the checkbook, who pays the bills and pays them on time.
Yeah.
Just the little simple things.
Yeah, and for whom is it less loathsome? Who doesn't seem to mind it as much, so it's not such a big deal? You know, I would add that to it. Now,
right.
Of time, Meredith, I can't believe it's already 8:26, but I would like us to take a moment to tell our listeners about a special upcoming event that we're going to be providing related to this issue of collaboration, communication, and conflict. For any of you out there wanting an in-depth experiential learning related to this, then you should know about that Meredith and I are going to have a next couples retreat on May 16th to 18th at the Victoria Inn in Hampton on the coast of New Hampshire. And we've titled it Better Communication deeper connection and reduced conflict. You want to tell our listeners a little bit about it, Meredith?
Certainly. So we are taking over a lovely bed and breakfast in the area. We have people arriving after work on Friday, and we'll have some appetizers available for a little meet and greet. And then people will be able to settle in. We'll get to work with people a little that evening, and then the next morning, breakfast, and then we get started, and we will spend the day together. There'll be time to go off and have lunch and dinner, and then the next morning, we will be back at it. We'll have breakfast, and we'll have half a day together then.
And it's for, we've designed it, there are going to be six couples at this event, total six?
Yes, five to six couples.
Okay, so we're going to take over the inn, and
yes,
which is very nice, so that it's our space. There'll be six couples, and we really designed it for high-functioning, committed couples who maybe have grown a little bit distant and who could use some help reconnecting, right?
Right.
And this is not for very chaotic couples who are at war with each other, but for people who love each other, they know that they want to stay together, and maybe things have gotten a little flat. And so we're going to focus on how we can deepen communication, connection, and help them manage conflict in a more manageable way. And one of the things that I'm very excited about, Meredith, I know you are, is that we're going to be providing these couples a mediated environment. So they're not just doing their usual dance with each other, and feedback from us in real time about these issues, which I think is really important. And not to mention the fact that it's a gorgeous setting and it's conducive to reflection, learning, and fun, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. I mean, I would say they get to spend a lot of time with us, and it's the two of us. It's not just one. So they get our feedback during that time, but they also get the feedback of others in the group. And we'll have experiential exercises. I think that there will be a lot of learning for everyone involved.
Yeah, I think so. And what listeners need to know, you probably already know, maybe you don't, is that Meredith creates retreats. I actually went to a retreat that Meredith held on Star Island. We're going to be doing another one in June on Star Island, but that's how I found out about you and retreats, Meredith, and how you're quite the expert at retreats. All I know is that everybody who went to that retreat on Star Island, they're best friends forever on Facebook. They've never stopped emailing and leaving messages for each other. There was a lot of bonding. And I know for myself, even in the brief time I went there, a lot of learning and a lot of, it was just very stimulating and very enlarging. It kind of opened me up in some very important ways and opened other people up. So you're really the expert at it, and I'm going to be doing it with you, so I'm very excited. And I think for anybody listening to this show, this should be very relevant because money is a major source of a divide in communication, a lack of connection, and a lack of collaboration. So we're not going to be focusing on money on the retreat, but we'll be teaching people skills so they can manage this among other issues. Wouldn't you say?
Correct.
I agree
with that. Thank you very much. And I'm really looking forward to doing a retreat with you. I think it will be a lot of fun.
It should be. It should be. Now, anybody who's interested in registering or for more information can either contact Meredith at 207-439-4267, which is your business number at Resolution.
Correct.
Or me at the Couple Center at 603-431-7131, or you can email Meredith at meredithmediates@aol.com, or email me at couplespeak@gmail.com. Okay. Now, what's our cutoff date for it, Meredith? I think I should just mention that, because people don't have forever to think about it.
Right. So we would like people to register early, and we're willing to give people a little discount to make that happen. We're looking at 5% off if they register by, what was it, Susan, April? Do you remember which day?
Remember which day? I don't have the note in front of me.
So if they register by April 11th, then they get 5% off.
Okay.
And we're really looking for people to register by May 1st.
Okay.
Because the retreat is May 16th, so that would be 2 weeks in advance, and that would give us a good idea of who's coming.
Okay. So anybody listening, there are only 6 couples who can participate in this. You do not have forever. Call either one of us or email either one of us, and you can find out more information. All right. Now, to get back to our topic, what I think would be a good idea, Meredith, for us to spend the rest of our time talking about some tips that we have, some things that we've each learned that could be helpful for individuals and couples managing money. Don't you think?
Okay. I do.
One
we
of the things
that we have to deliver it.
Okay. All right. Let's deliver. Now, one of the things I recommend to couples that they look at me like I've just invented white bread. They just love this idea, is the whole concept of, instead of having divisive roles around this or very stereotypical roles, for them to create a yours, a mine, and an ours around money. And so, for instance, to instead of put everything in the same pool and have to be accountable to each other for every little penny that's spent, to have one account where you agree ahead of time what are the things that you are paying for through that account, like the mortgage, kids' education, food, et cetera, and then to have separate, I call them slush funds, to which you do not have to account to each other, and to decide on the front end what percentage of the money that's coming in or what dollar amount you want to allocate to those funds. So let's say a couple decides, let's put all the money in the joint account and let's reserve maybe $100 to $200 a month for our individual slush funds. The whole concept of that is that you legitimize separateness. I mean, you legitimize collaboration around the big things, but you also legitimize a certain amount of independence. So if one person in the marriage wants to spend money on doodads for the house, they don't have to get a seal of approval from the partner. If the other person wants to save that money toward a new tractor or a big ticket item, they can do it. You're not looking over each other's shoulders. And I can tell you, Meredith, I don't know if you see this in your work with couples, but people love this idea.
I see in my work people who are on their second marriage or more often do not combine accounts. And so maybe they did it in their first marriage and they may have had the power dynamics that you and I have talked about in terms of things going awry. And so they're a little more wary about pooling their money the second or third time around. And so they will maintain separate accounts. And I think that that can also be used as a way that you were talking about in terms of allowing people to have the freedom to do what they want with their money. And at the same time, making it so that each of them are accountable to pay a certain amount. Still, if there are large differences in the amount of earning power on one side or the other, it still can be problematic, because without having that joint account, then you can end up having, you know, the person that's earning less could be able to afford substantially less. And so you can end up with that kind of a dynamic where one person in the relationship is fairly wealthy and the other person is fairly poor, even though they are actually married. And that is its own little problematic dynamic.
Yeah,
I think that it's, you know, it's good to have people able to each look at what is going on in terms of the money and really have a feel for it. I think that that's one of the things that you and I talked about as well, is when you have somebody who's just not paying attention to the money, who's relying on the other person to take care of the money, it can lead to some crazy spending, as we talked about, or entitlement. But it also can just be really detrimental if you don't know what you actually have for money when it comes time to divorce, should it come time to divorce, you could really be at a disadvantage.
Or if the other partner dies, you can be completely in the...
That would be awful, yes.
Yeah, so either way, it doesn't... So it disempowers one partner. It also, I think, you know, it doesn't do anything in the collaborative department. So being mindful about where you share and how you balance sharing with individual prerogative, I think, is really important. Now, in the interest of time, you mentioned another one, which I think we should kind of highlight again. Play to your strengths. Don't just default to stereotype roles. Play to your strengths. See who's better at it. And let that person be the one who tracks it, or the person who does the bookkeeping or just pays the bills. Don't assume that the person who makes more money is better at it.
Right.
Now, you mentioned one when we were talking about this show, to hire out if nobody's good at it. And I wonder if you could say something about that.
It can just be an incredibly stressful thing, and I think a lot of people do hire out in terms of not doing their own taxes. Maybe they have an accountant doing the taxes, but even taking it one step further and talking with a financial planner, talking with someone who provide there are people who will provide money management services specifically for those who cannot manage their money. So if neither of you in the relationship is good at that type of thing, then talk to a professional who specializes in that.
I've helped couples get out of a war with each other where they were just going around in circles about what's the best way to go financially. And neither of them really knew what they were talking about. And I remember suggesting, have you gone to a financial planner and talked to an actual expert about this? And then when they finally did, it ended the war. It was no longer in the realm of subjective. Now it was they were talking to somebody who really knew what they were talking about, and they could be on the same page. So it can really end a kind of a polarization around money, or a polarization about financial choices. So I
right.
think I support that, and I've seen how that makes a huge difference.
I would add too, just getting to getting the right tools in place. So
mm-hmm.
I know some people with ADD, they have trouble actually getting the bills paid on time, and so it can be helpful for them to have electronic bill pay, where it's just set up to automatically come out of their account every month. So it could be
okay.
something that someone who is used to balancing their checkbook, that might make them a little crazy to have these things coming out and unplanned and then looking it over later. But for someone who has trouble paying the bills, that could be all that they need in terms of getting the bills paid.
You talked about using graphics if
yes,
you're a visual person.
That's what I was going to say, too, is some people can't visualize the numbers. The numbers just don't mean anything to them. And so if you plugged it into a spreadsheet, if you plugged it into Mint.com, or you had some kind of software that you had, and you could see it as a pie chart instead of seeing it as just the numbers, so that different people visualize it different ways. For some people, they need it to be spoken. That's how they process things. So think about how it is that you need to take it in, and then find a way to take it in, because it's not okay to just not know anything about it. You'll put yourself really at a disadvantage if you just ignore it.
Okay, so in other words, respect your process and use tools that go along with your particular process.
Yes.
Okay.
And advocate for your process as well. I mean, it may be that it makes perfect sense to your partner the way that it's laid out, but if you have a different process, you need to find a way to make it so that you can understand it as well.
Yeah, yeah. Now, one of the things I recommend that couples do also is to have money meetings and to create a vision about what would we like our life to look like moving forward, and in terms of lifestyle and choices and prerogatives, and then to schedule in some regular money meetings where you're looking at what's the goal and what's the action plan and how do the two line up with each other. Are we, if we are saying we want to travel, for instance, how much have we traveled this year? How much have we put away toward travel? Are we lining up our behaviors with the goal in a way that's viable? And what I say to people about any of those kinds of meetings is don't wait for the motivation to just drop out of the sky. You're not going to wake up one Saturday morning and say, gee, I can't wait to have a money meeting. But not usually. Just do it, and you'll really be glad that you did it. And it's a kind of check and balance in the system. And you had one when we were talking about it. I'm wondering if you could mention it before we close about rethinking a joint return.
Oh, so sometimes people come to me and their spouse, well, one spouse may not be earning their money legally. So they could be involved in some kind of illegal activity. And I'm not talking about working under the table, but I do want to talk about that as well. I'm talking about actually illegal, could go to jail for this type of activity. And if your name is on that return too, and they are vastly underreporting their income because it's illegal and they don't want to report it because that would flag it, then you could be liable also for paying back the IRS for money that should have gone to the IRS. And the other thing is that, you know, Al Capone wasn't convicted for all of his alleged illegal activity. He went to jail for tax fraud. So when you're signing a joint return with someone, think about that if you know that they're involved in an illegal activity. With respect to people who earn under the table, or, you know, who some people who are self-employed find creative ways that their accountant might not agree with to have their taxes look lower than they should. And again, if you're signing a joint return, then you can be on the hook for repaying the government if that's found. And okay. I do see that happen, and what I see happen is that usually those cases settle. People don't want to go to trial on that and have to testify under oath about that because then the judge would have to report it to the IRS, and then it would be problematic for the people involved.
Yeah.
But there's always that risk that that could happen. So,
okay, so very mindful about a joint return and when it's called for and when it could really put you at risk.
Right, and that would be a tough conversation to have with the other person, I'm sure, that would bring up. And, you know, probably one of the reasons that people do sign the joint returns because they don't want to say, I don't really like the way that you're handling your money, so I'm going to file separately this year. But at the same time, it could really protect you in the long run. You know, the IRS does look at, you know, if you're an innocent spouse that didn't know that these things were going on, you can ask that the IRS take that into account. You can file that. But you really don't want to put yourself in that position. It's much easier if you just don't file that joint return.
Right, right. And bring up the conflictual thing instead and stand up for yourself rather than be in trouble with the IRS. Absolutely. Well, Meredith, that's a great point. And we're out of time. I don't know if you can believe it. It's the end of the show. Time flies.
It always goes faster than I think it's going to.
Yeah, always, always. In any event, there are a number of callers that are on the air. Nobody has asked any questions, so I guess there aren't any questions. So we are going to have to wrap up, but I thank you for joining me, Meredith. I'm really looking forward to doing these shows with you and having a conversation once a month rather than me just talking out into the void by myself and listening to my own echo. I always love doing collaborative things with you. And,
well, thank you. I have a lot of fun with it as well.
Yeah, yeah, always. Now, you can reach Meredith for mediation or conflict coaching at her business Resolution in Elliott, Maine, at 207-439-4267, or email her at meredithmediates@aol.com, or go to her website. What's your actual website URL, Meredith?
www.meredithmediates.com.
Okay, that's easy. www.meredithmediates.com. And my website's easy. It's susanlager.com. If you'd like to contact me. And again, if you're interested in that, in the retreat, you don't have forever to sit on it. Just contact either one of us. My next episode will be in 2 weeks on Wednesday, March 12th at 8 p.m. I'm going to a slightly earlier time because I realize the whole world is not a vampire like me. It's going to be 8 p.m. and the topic will be announced. This will just be me. I may have a guest. I'll be announcing that. But anyway, good night, everyone, and happy tax time. And thanks again, Meredith. Thanks for joining me.
Good night. Thank you, Susan.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.